AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is where we really dig into all the sources on a, well, sometimes complicated, always fascinating topic. We pull out the key stuff so you walk away feeling like you truly get it. Mm-hmm. And today we are cracking open the case on Jeff Dunham, American ventriloquist, stand-up, actor, one of the most successful comedians out there.
Absolutely. And definitely polarizing. You know, people either seem to love him or not.
Right. But we're going to try and focus on the whole picture today. His success is undeniable. His influence in bringing ventriloquism back, it's huge.
Yeah, it really is a study in extremes, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you look at his technique, the skill level.
Yeah.
It's mastery. He basically resurrected an art form that a lot of people thought was, you know, kind of dead and buried.
Totally. But then you look at how he did it, those characters.
Exactly. They're often, let's be frank, politically incorrect. They can be pretty insulting. They're designed, it feels like, to push buttons.
And that's the real core of it, isn't it? That tension is what we need to unpack. So our mission for you listening is to trace that story. We're going from this kid in Texas, totally obsessed with the mechanics of ventriloquism.
Yeah, it's just hobbyist, really.
Through, like, decades where nobody in the industry really got it, right? Years of obscurity, and then boom, global superstar filling arenas.
And we have to look at how he built that empire of puppets, why they work, and why that success story is just inherently tangled up with all the controversy, globally even.
We really have to start with the numbers, though, just the sheer size of his success.
It's hard to overstate it, especially coming from ventriloquism, which, let's face it, was not exactly setting the world on fire before him.
No kidding. I mean, the scale is just wild. It's literally in the record books. Guinness World Record holder.
Right. For most tickets sold for a stand-up comedy tour.
And that's not most tickets for a ventriloquist tour. It's any stand-up comedian. He sold almost 2 million tickets. The number is 1,981,720 tickets across 386 venues.
For one tour, the Spark of Insanity tour. That was 2007 to 2010.
It's staggering.
And that kind of demand, well, it translates directly into serious money, financial clout that puts him up there with, you know, the Seinfelds, the Chris Rocks of the world.
Yeah, Forbes had him ranked as the third highest paid comedian globally back in 2009, said he pulled in something like $30 million that year alone.
Right. So when you see figures like that, you realize, okay, this isn't just some guy with puppets. It's a global brand built on, well, wood, plastic, and incredible technique.
Okay, let's dig into that journey, because the drive, the ambition, it started incredibly early.
It really did.
So Jeff Dunham, born Jeffrey Douglas Dunham, Dallas, Texas, 1962. He was adopted at 3 months old. Howard, his dad, was a real estate appraiser. Joyce, his mom, a homemaker, raised an only child.
And the sources describe it as, you know, a pretty affluent background.
Yeah.
And devoutly Presbyterian, quite traditional, disciplined.
Yeah, sounds like it. And then into this kind of controlled environment comes this catalyst.
The spark, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't random. It was Christmas, 1970. He's 8 years old.
And he gets what? A dummy?
A Mortimer Snerd dummy. Classic.
Yeah.
And this is key, a how-to album to go with it. For a kid like him, apparently very dedicated. This wasn't just a toy. It was like homework he actually wanted to do.
Right. He dove right in. The very next day, he's down at the library, checks out a how-to book on ventriloquism.
Which he still jokes he stole.
Yeah.
Says he never returned it.
Ah. Okay. And by fourth grade, he's already decided this isn't just going to be a hobby.
No way. He set this goal. And it wasn't just, I want to be a professional ventriloquist. It was, I want to be the best one ever.
Wow. At like 9 or 10 years old?
Yeah. That's obsession, right? It went from childhood interest to like professional mission almost overnight.
And that kind of goal requires serious dedication.
Oh, absolutely. Relentless practice. Solitary practice, hours in front of a mirror. He wasn't just working on the, you know, not moving his lips part. He was studying the greats, Edgar Bergen, the routines, the timing.
Mm-hmm. And he studied that record too, Jimmy Nelson's Instant Ventriloquism.
Right. He always insists, you know, it's not magic. It's a learned skill. He compares it to juggling.
Just sheer repetition until it's second nature.
Exactly. So you can focus on the comedy, not the mechanics.
There's something else important here too about his personality. The sources mention this. Solitude factor.
Yeah, that's really interesting. As an only child, he apparently really grew comfortable being alone. He even called it like a warm blanket. And that comfort with being by himself, it wasn't just a personality trait. It turned out to be like fundamental training for his later career.
How so?
Well, think about the life of a comedian starting out,
Yeah.
especially one touring constantly. It's a lonely role.
Long drives, cheap motels, just you and your puppets.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that ability he developed early on to just sit by himself for hours, work on ideas, practice technique without needing anyone else around. That became crucial when he hit the professional grind later. It prepared him for that isolation.
Makes sense. And that grind, that professional part, started pretty early, too. Sixth grade, he starts going to this big ventriloquist
The
convention.
Vent Haven Convention, yeah, in Kentucky. It's like the big annual meetup for ventriloquists. He started going then, and apparently he's only missed one year since, back in 1977.
And this is where he really starts to stand out, right? Not just a kid practicing, but actually
Oh,
good.
yeah. He met his hero there, Jimmy Nelson. And he started competing, and he was so good, apparently.
Too good.
Pretty much. The organizers eventually had to declare him a retired champion. Basically, they stopped letting him compete because nobody else wanted to go up against him. They were too intimidated.
That's incredible. So the community knew he was something special way before the mainstream caught on.
Totally. The Vent Haven Museum even has a section dedicated to him now, right alongside the legends like Signor Wences and Edgar Bergen. That says a lot.
So this early validation, it must have fueled him. He starts doing paid gigs as a teenager.
Yeah, performing at school, at church, even during his summer job at Six Flags. And this is where you really start to see his signature style develop.
The puppet as the shield.
Exactly. He realized he could use the puppets to say things that he, Jeff, this polite, well-raised kid, couldn't really get away with.
Like making fun of people.
Yeah, lampooning them. There's a story about him mocking the Dallas Cowboys quarterback, Roger Staubach, using a dummy back in middle school. The puppet could deliver the punch, the edge, that he couldn't personally.
So he graduates high school in 1980, voted most likely to succeed, which is fitting.
Right. And then he sets this incredibly specific goal for himself, a 10-year deadline,
Which was,
an appearance on The Tonight Show starring
yeah.
Johnny Carson.
Wow. That was the absolute pinnacle back then, right? The holy grail for comedians.
Absolutely. If Carson liked you, invited you to the couch, your career could explode overnight.
So how did he approach that goal? Did he just head straight for LA?
No, actually, he took a more measured path first. He went to Baylor University, got a communications degree, graduated in 86.
But he wasn't just being a student.
Not at all. College was like his day job. On weekends, he was flying all over the country doing private shows, sometimes up to 100 gigs a year.
Mostly corporate events.
Yeah, high-paying corporate gigs. And this circuit was incredibly important. It was lucrative, for one. By his junior year, like 83, 84, he was apparently already making $70,000 a year.
70 grand a year. As a college student in the early 80s, that's serious money.
It really was. It showed the demand for what he did, even then. High polish entertainment for corporations.
And performing for CEOs and executives must have taught him a lot, too.
Definitely. He got good at handling those high-stakes audiences. The sources mention him even mocking big-shot CEOs like Jack Welch from GE during his routines.
Using the puppets, presumably.
Of course, that combination, the polished professional guy and the puppet saying the outrageous stuff, that whole act was really honed on that corporate circuit.
Okay, so he graduates college. He's got the skills, the experience, the ambition. What's next? Broadway.
Surprisingly, yes. In 1985, he actually got a break joining the Broadway show Sugar Babies. He replaced another variety act, got to work alongside huge old school stars like Mickey Rooney and Ann Miller.
Whoa, that must have been a culture shock going from, devout Texas upbringing and corporate gigs to Broadway.
Totally. He described it as this whole new world full of beautiful showgirls and crusty stagehands, as the sources put it. A real crash course in the grittier side of show business.
And maybe a bit of an ego check, too.
Oh, definitely. There's a great story about Mickey Rooney calling him into his dressing room.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, Rooney basically told him flat out, "Look, kid, you're only on that stage, so I have time to change my costume backstage."
Ouch. Welcome to the big leagues.
Pretty much. A stark reminder of the pecking order in show business. No matter how good you are, you're just scenery for the star.
But these early experiences, even the tough ones, they must have helped him adapt his material, right?
Absolutely. Working with those different audiences, like on Broadway, and using characters like Jose Jalapeno on a stick, who he developed pretty early.
Right, the one he made himself.
Yeah. He learned fast that what killed in Dallas might completely bomb in, say, Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
You had to tweak the jokes, the references, regionalize the humor. That became super important later for his national tours.
Okay, so Broadway, regional gigs. But the real goal was stand-up comedy, centered in L.A. He moved there in 88.
He did, and that's where he hit a wall.
Yeah.
Initially, his act just bombed.
Why? Was it just not funny?
It wasn't just that. The L.A. comedy scene back then was really dominated by observational stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Seinfeld was Breaking Big, that whole style.
Talking about everyday stuff.
Exactly. And here comes Dunham with puppets. He was immediately seen as different. Not in a good way, necessarily. More like a novelty act. A prop comic.
So prejudice within the comedy community itself.
Yeah, definitely. Other comedians didn't really see him as a true comedian. His own manager, Judy Brown Marmel, apparently had to be really careful booking him.
How?
She would deliberately avoid using the word ventriloquist. She'd pitch him as a comedy duo just to get him stage time.
Wow. That's fighting uphill.
Totally. And he had experiences that really hammered that home. Like one time at the famous Catch a Rising Star Club.
Yeah.
The MC just gave him zero respect. Saw him as the lowest act on the bill. Kept bumping his stage time later and later. Until Dunham finally just got fed up and left without even performing.
That must have been incredibly frustrating, just constantly feeling like your art form isn't taken seriously.
Exactly. But he needed a place to work, to develop his act away from that mainstream LA club hostility.
Mm-hmm.
And he found it.
Where was that?
The Comedy and Magic Club down in Hermosa Beach. The owner, Mike Lacey, gave him a regular spot.
Okay, so a home base.
Yeah. And yep. That was crucial. It let him watch other comedians, really study guys like Seinfeld, who were killing it. He got advice from people like Bill Engvall, too.
And the advice was?
Basically, toughen up the material. Move away from the safer, G-rated stuff he'd done for corporates and churches. Get edgier. More adult themes that would connect with those late-night club crowds.
And all this work, all this sharpening, it was still aimed at that one big goal, right? The Carson Show, that 10-year deadline he set.
Still driving him.
Yeah.
And in late 1988, it looked like it was finally going to happen. The Tonight Show talent booker, Jim McCauley, actually promised him a spot. He was this close.
But there's always a but in these stories.
There is. McCauley saw Dunham perform somewhere else, opening for Roseanne Barr, I think. And the day before the taping, he canceled it.
No.
Said Dunham was not ready. Could you imagine? Your lifelong dreams snatched away at the last second.
Devastating. So what did Dunham do? Give up?
Not a chance. This is where that insane dedication kicks back in. Instead of changing his act or begging, he just kept showing up. He performed the exact same six-minute routine, the one with Peanut, for McCauley. 9 different times over the next few months.
The exact same routine. 9 times.
Yep.
Yeah.
Basically saying, this is the act. It's ready. You need to be ready for it. Total refusal to back down.
That takes some serious...
Whoa. Guts. Or stubbornness.
Yeah.
Probably both. And eventually, it worked.
He got the spot.
He did. April 6, 1990, he finally appeared on The Tonight Show, starring Johnny Carson. On the same show as Bob Hope and B.B. King, no less.
Wow. And did he get the couch? That was the big thing, right?
He got the couch. Carson invited him over after his set. That was the ultimate seal of approval. It meant Johnny saw him as more than just a variety act. He saw him as a comedian. A potential star.
And then Walter made his debut there, too, right?
Yeah, Walter came out swinging, took a shot straight at Ed McMahon, Carson's sidekick. Stop sending me all your damn mail.
Classic Walter. So this was it, the peak. Goal achieved. Smooth sailing from here.
You'd think so, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But no. First, there was this immediate kind of personal friction. His parents, remember, devoutly religious. Mm. They apparently disapproved of Walter, using words like hell and damn on national TV. So right away, there's that tension between his roots and where his comedy needed to go.
Mm. And career-wise, did the phone start ringing off the hook?
Not exactly. That's the surprising part. The sources say, despite nailing the Carson appearance, he then basically toiled in obscurity for another 12 years.
12 years after Carson.
Yeah. He just kept doing stand-up in clubs, hundreds of shows a year, 200 plus sometimes. The Carson spot validated him, but it didn't magically transform his career overnight into arena tours.
But he was doing something smart during that time, right? Building a fan base directly.
Yes, absolutely crucial. He used those question cards that audiences filled out during his shows.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't just using them for jokes. He was collecting names and addresses, building an early fan database.
Which was perfect for
the internet. When the World Wide Web started taking off, He already had this direct line to his core audience. He could email them, let them know where he was performing, sell merch directly. It kept him connected even when his TV profile dipped.
Smart move, because things did dip, didn't they? Mid-90s, early 2000s.
Yeah, that was definitely a tough period. Fewer TV appearances, smaller crowds sometimes, and the relentless touring schedule. Being away constantly, 2 or 3 weeks every month.
That had to take a toll, personally.
It did. The sources point to that schedule as a major factor contributing to the strain in his first marriage. He really needed another break, a way back into wider public view.
And it came from an unexpected place. Sports TV?
Kind of random, yeah. In 2002, he did a spot on the best damn sports show, period. And he just went for it, letting Walter rip into the co-hosts, Tom Arnold, Michael Irvin, John Sally, John Croke.
Risky.
But it worked. He got people talking, showed he could be edgy and funny outside a traditional comedy club setting, generated some much-needed buzz.
Did that lead to other opportunities?
Almost a huge one. In 2003, he was apparently the front runner to replace Jimmy Kimmel on the Fox NFL Sunday pregame show.
Wow, that would have been massive exposure.
Huge. But it didn't happen. Again, it seems the whole puppet thing got in the way.
Seriously, the hosts didn't like it.
According to the sources, yeah. The veteran hosts, Howie Long and Terry Bradshaw, were reportedly not amenable to the idea of being upstaged by a puppet. They apparently created an unwelcoming vibe. He still felt like an outsider.
Man, that prejudice just wouldn't quit, even when he finally got his own solo special on Comedy Central.
Right. His Comedy Central presence in 2003, it did well, showcased Walter, Jose, Peanut, even an early version of Melvin the Superhero Guy.
But the network was still hesitant.
Yeah, they just didn't see him as fitting their brand at the time. They were more focused on, you know, younger alternative stand-ups. They resisted giving him more airtime, even though the special was successful.
So what did he do? Just wait for them to change their minds?
Nope. He took matters into his own hands, made a massive financial gamble in 2005.
Which was?
He financed his own DVD, produced it himself. Jeff Dunham. Arguing with myself.
That's a big risk, pouring your own money into a production like that.
Huge risk. And then his manager, Judy Brown Marmel, had to basically strong-arm Comedy Central into airing it. She argued, look, this guy sells tickets, he sells merchandise, the audience is there, you need him.
Did they buy it?
Eventually.
Yeah.
They aired Arguing With Myself late in 2006. O'Reilly!
Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today. O'Reilly
Auto Parts. And it exploded.
How big?
2 million viewers right off the bat. And it sold 2 million DVDs instantly.
Wow, okay.
That kind of immediate, massive success. Mm. It completely validated Dunham and his manager. It basically forced Comedy Central to realize they had a potential phenomenon on their hands. Whether he fit their old brand or not, he was making them money. Lots of it.
And that really opened the floodgates, didn't it? That led to the next phase, global stardom.
Absolutely. Once Comedy Central was fully on board, things just took off astronomically. His next special, Jeff Dunham. Spark of Insanity, in 2007, that was the one.
That cemented everything.
Pretty much. Yeah. And crucially, it introduced the character that would become his most famous and definitely his most controversial.
Ock Meet the Dead terrorist.
Bingo. And the way Ockbid broke through was kind of new territory back then.
Viral, right, on YouTube.
Exactly. A clip from Spark of Insanity featuring Ockbid just went completely ballistic online. We're talking over 140 million views by 2009. That made it like the 9th most watched video on all of YouTube at the time.
Incredible. And that online buzz translated into real world demand.
Oh, yeah. That viral fame directly fueled the record-breaking tour we talked about earlier, the Spark of Insanity tour. Nearly 2 million tickets sold worldwide.
The records just kept piling up after that.
They did. 2008, he does Jeff Dunham's very special Christmas special, sets another record. Highest rated show ever in Comedy Central history at that point, 6.6 million viewers.
Wow. And the DVD sales?
Sold over 400,000 copies in just the first 2 weeks. That special also had that Ockden song.
Jingle Bombs.
All right.
Controversial, but undeniably popular.
That's the Dunham story in a nutshell, isn't it?
Yeah. So by late 2008, he's not playing clubs anymore. He's in arenas. Tens of thousands of people.
Right. And that required a whole different approach to performing. He actually had to adjust his timing.
Honey, meme.
Well, his act relies on those super-fast back-and-forth exchanges with the puppets. In an arena, the sound takes time to travel. People way in the back hear the joke later than people up front.
So the laughs would be staggered.
Exactly. Yeah. So he had to learn to deliberately slow down those exchanges, leave slightly longer pauses so the sound could reach everyone, they could process the joke, and the laugh would hit all at once across the whole arena. It's a technical adjustment you wouldn't even think about.
Fascinating. So, arenas, record-breaking specials. The next logical step seemed to be his own TV show.
Yeah, The Jeff Dunham Show premiered on Comedy Central in 2009. And guess what?
Record-breaking premiere.
You got it. Yeah. Most watched premiere in the network's history. But it didn't last.
Why not? What happened?
It seems the format just didn't quite work for his style. The critics mostly panned it. The ratings dropped off pretty quickly after the premiere. And apparently it was really expensive to produce.
So canceled after one season.
Yeah. It seemed like those big, high-energy, one-off specials were a much better fit for him than a weekly sitcom-style show.
But that didn't really slow down his overall momentum, did it? He kept touring, kept putting out specials.
Not at all. He followed up with Controlled Chaos that one pulled in like 8.3 million viewers. Then All Over the Map, which was really interesting, they taped it during performances on 5 different continents.
Really showcasing that global reach.
Totally. And he got other accolades, too. A star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in 2017. He started doing more film and TV roles, too. Popped up in Dinner for Schmucks.
With a new puppet, Diane, right.
Yeah. And he did cameos on shows like 30 Rock. Brought Bubba J along for that one.
Okay, let's dive into the characters themselves, because they are the absolute engine driving this whole thing.
They really are. Time magazine had a great description of his style. They called the characters politically incorrect, gratuitously insulting, and ill-tempered.
Sounds about right.
And they called Dunham himself a dressed-down, more digestible version of Don Rickles with multiple personality disorder, which is pretty sharp.
Yeah. But they also credited him, rightly, with doing more to promote ventriloquism than anyone since Edgar Bergen.
Which is undeniable. So the core characters. So let's start with the original grumpy old man, Walter.
Arms always crossed, always complaining.
Right. Dunham actually sculpted Walter himself. And he apparently patterned that iconic frown on his own face when he frowned.
Huh. Interesting. And the personality, where did that come from?
He said he was inspired by watching Bette Davis on Carson. Just her total lack of filter, that unfiltered candor. That's Walter.
He's the ultimate cynic, right? Vietnam vet, former welder, just angry at the world.
Pretty much. His whole comedy comes from being sarcastic, negative, refusing to be happy. Like that classic joke about his marriage.
The happiest moment.
Yeah. Happiest moment of his 46-year marriage. 47 years ago. Perfect Walter.
Okay. Then there's Peanut. Totally different energy.
Complete opposite. Hyperactive, purple-skinned thing. He calls himself a woozle. Green hair, one sneaker.
Just pure chaos.
Exactly. And Peanut's humor isn't based on a stereotype like some of the others. He's just the bad kid.
Yeah.
High energy, always bouncing off the walls, usually making fun of Jose.
And he has that great meta line, right? Asking Dunham how he came up with him without drugs.
Yeah. Then how the hell did you come up with me? He kind of acknowledges the absurdity of the whole thing. Peanut claims he's from Micronesia, but doesn't really matter. He's just this force of disruptive energy.
And Jose, jalapeno, on a stick.
On a stick. Can't forget that part. The talking jalapeno pepper, little sombrero, thick accent.
And he was the first one Dunham actually made himself.
That's right. Which makes him pretty significant. He's usually the quiet foil to Peanut's craziness. And Peanut never lets him forget he's
on a stick, yeah.
Then you've got Bubba J.
The redneck stereotype. Beer. NASCAR.
Pretty much. Used for all the white trash or trailer park humor. Low intelligence jokes, that kind of thing. Dunham actually said Bubba J was inspired by one of Edgar Bergen's characters, Mortimer Snerd.
Ah, okay. And Bubba J's got those classic lines about meeting his wife at the family reunion.
Leaning against a Ferris wheel with a corn dog and a beer.
Yeah.
Yeah. He perfectly embodies that specific cultural caricature.
Okay. And now exit Achmed.
The lightning rod.
Yeah.
Achmed, the dead terrorist. The skeletal corpse of a suicide bomber who wasn't very good at his job.
Hence the dead part. Due to premature detonation, as he says.
Right. And his catchphrase,
"Silence, I kill you," became huge.
Absolutely huge. He was designed, Dunham says, to satirize terrorism through incompetence and absurdity. Make it seem ridiculous, not just scary.
But extremely controversial.
Oh, massively. But Dunham built in a defense. Sort of. He has Achmed deny being Muslim.
Right. The "look at my ass, it says made in China" line.
Exactly. Trying to position him as this generic, absurd figure of terror, not a specific religious or ethnic commentary. Didn't always work, but that was the intent. Ahmed even got his own animated movie eventually, Ahmed Saves America.
The cast keeps going, though. There's Sweet Daddy D.
Right, the pimp. Although he insists it means player in the management profession.
Uh-huh. And Jeff is the hoe.
Because he makes people laugh and feel good. Yeah. He's sort of this parody of a slick, slightly outdated manager type. Hates NASCAR, naturally.
And Melvin, the superhero guy.
Melvin. He's there to poke fun at the whole superhero craze. Claims he has X-ray vision.
I love looking at boobies.
Right. But otherwise, completely powerless. Can only fly as far as Jeff can throw him.
And he makes jokes about other heroes.
Yeah, says the Flash must be on meth. The Hulk is like every guy on Cop PS, just bringing superheroes down to a mundane, slightly trashy level.
And the lineup keeps evolving, right? He adds new characters.
He does. More recently, there was Seamus.
The Irish baby.
Yeah.
From the special filmed in Ireland.
That's the one. Grumpy beer-drinking baby. Used for Irish stereotype jokes, but also, interestingly, to comment on the 2016 U.S. election candidates.
And the newest one, Earl.
Yeah, Earl. Introduced in 2022. He's basically the stereotype of a young person totally glued to their phone, living in their parents' basement.
Tapping into current anxieties about screen time and, you know, kids today.
Exactly. Dunham said everyone can relate to being stuck on their devices too much, so Earl reflects that contemporary issue.
Okay, so we have this whole ensemble cast, wildly popular, but we have to talk about the controversy. It's unavoidable.
Absolutely central to his story. Critics, like Randy Dawn, have explicitly accused the characters of being racist caricatures. Sexist, homophobic too, that's the core criticism.
And it's not just critics writing articles, it's had real-world impacts, like censorship.
Definitely. Back in 2008, South Africa banned a TV commercial that featured Ahmed. A complaint was filed saying it was offensive to Muslims, that it painted all Muslims as terrorists. The Advertising Standards Authority there agreed, noting that even the name Ahmed is Arab, regardless of what the puppet says in the act.
So how does Dunham respond to that kind of accusation, that kind of action?
His defense is pretty consistent. It's basically rooted in free speech for comedy. He counters by saying he makes fun of everyone.
He listed them off, right?
Yeah, quote, "I've skewered whites, blacks, Hispanics, Asians, Christians, Jews, Muslims, gays, straights, rednecks, addicts, the elderly, and my wife."
Covering all bases there.
His argument is, look, I'm a stand-up comic. My job is to make the majority of people laugh. And he believes comedy is, or should be, the last true form of free speech.
Did he ever actually consider changing Ahmed?
He joked about renaming him Bill, just to get around the name issue, which kind of highlights his frustration with being told who he can and can't make fun of.
But it's interesting. While he claims to target everyone equally, he did admit to being maybe a bit more careful with one group.
Yeah. He conceded he's particularly sensitive when it comes to the conservative country crowd or people with basic Christian values.
Why them specifically?
Well, partly because they form a huge chunk of his audience, and partly maybe because it reflects his own upbringing. So there seems to be a line between potentially offending a group and actively alienating his core fan base.
That balancing act came up again internationally, didn't it? In Malaysia?
It did. Mm-hmm. In 2014, he was scheduled to perform there, but the government stepped in. They requested that Ahmed specifically not be used or even named due to local sensitivities about terrorism portrayal.
So did he just cut Ahmed from the show?
No, he adapted. This is fascinating.
Yeah.
For that one show in Malaysia, Ahmed became Jacques Merde, the dead French terrorist.
Jacques Merde, as in...
Jacques Chit, literally. So he kept the core concept, the dead terrorist, kept the edginess, but shifted the cultural target just enough to satisfy the censors. It's a pretty clever workaround for direct government interference.
Wow. Navigating global sensitivities with puppet name changes.
Okay, let's shift focus slightly. We've talked about the performer, the characters, the controversy. What about the man himself, his personal life?
Well, behind the loud stage persona, the sources paint a picture of someone, again, very dedicated, very meticulous. But his personal life was definitely impacted by that relentless career path.
His first marriage to Paige Brown. They married in 94.
Yeah. He adopted her daughter, Bree, and they had two more daughters together, Ashlyn and Kenna. But that insane touring schedule we talked about.
Away 2 or 3 weeks every month.
Exactly. The sources are pretty clear that put an immense strain on the marriage. He filed for divorce in 2008, right when his career was hitting that massive peak after the specials took off. Timing is rough there.
He remarried later.
Yes. In 2012, he married Audrey Murdoch. She's a certified nutritionist, personal trainer, even a competition bodybuilder.
Wow. Different world.
Yeah. And they had twin boys together in 2015, James Jeffrey and Jack Steven. So that brings his total number of kids to 5. Now, his hobbies are interesting, too. They seem to echo that same intense dedication we see in his work.
They really do. It's not just golf or something. He builds his own dummies, obviously, the current ones. Mm-hmm. But he also restores antique dummies.
It's like museum pieces.
Pretty much. It's more than just collecting. It involves really detailed engineering, understanding the history. There was one amazing project mentioned, the umpire.
The umpire? What was that?
It was this huge 6-foot-tall mechanized dummy built way back in 1941. It was designed to call balls and strikes at a girls' softball game.
You're kidding.
Nope. Apparently, it was built, never used, packed away for 50 years. Dunham got hold of it in 2008 and actually restored it back to full working condition.
That takes incredible patience and technical skill. Same stuff needed for ventriloquism, really.
Exactly. That meticulous technical mastery. But then there's the other side of his hobbies, the fast stuff.
Right. Helicopters.
Yeah, he apparently loved helicopters since he was a kid. But he doesn't just fly them. He builds them. His own kit helicopters from a company called Rotorway, he's built at least 4 himself.
Building your own helicopter, that requires a staggering amount of precision and nerve.
Totally. Again, it's that focus on complex mechanics, attention to detail, taking control of the whole process. Seems to fit the personality, right? Mastering something difficult and maybe a little overlooked.
And then there's the Batmobile.
Ah, yes. The ultimate prop. He owns the original Batmobile from the Tim Burton Batman movie.
The Michael Keaton one.
That's the one. But just owning it wasn't enough for him, apparently. Being the gearhead he is.
He modified it.
Put a Corvette engine in it. Made it fully street legal,
yeah.
So he can actually drive the Batmobile around.
Okay, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, he's also into muscle cars in general. And maybe less surprisingly, given his polished image, he's a big fan of Apple products.
So whether it's restoring an antique puppet, building a helicopter from a kit, or hot rodding the Batmobile, there's a pattern.
Definitely.
Yeah.
It all comes back to this deep interest in meticulous engineering, complex systems, and having total control over the details.
Okay, so let's try and bring this all together. We followed the whole path. 8-year-old kid gets a dummy for Christmas, sets this almost impossible goal.
Spends years, decades really, grinding it out, facing rejection from the comedy establishment, from networks.
Who just didn't get it, didn't respect the art form.
Right. And then he figures out how to use the new media landscape, viral videos, DVDs, direct fan contact, combines it with some savvy financial risk.
And builds this absolute empire. Record-breaking tours, massive specials, a global phenomenon.
He didn't just revive ventriloquism, he completely redefined it for the modern era. He took it out of the, you know, family-friendly variety show box.
And injected it with this aggressive, often offensive, definitely politically incorrect edge.
An edge that clearly resonates with a huge global audience. Maybe an audience that felt overlooked by more mainstream comedy.
Which brings us right back to that core contradiction. The success versus the controversy. Given all the criticism, the accusations of racism, sexism, given the actual censorship attempts we talked about.
South Africa, Malaysia.
Right. What does his unbelievable level of success actually tell us about comedy, about audiences, about free speech?
It really makes you think, doesn't it? It poses a fascinating question about, like, comedic shields. When a regular stand-up tells a joke, they own it completely. The backlash, the laughs, it's all on them.
But with Dunham, there's Walter, there's Ahmed, there's Peanut.
Exactly. Does the puppet act as this unique kind of buffer? Does it allow him, and maybe the audience too, to explore topics, push boundaries, laugh at things that would be way more uncomfortable, maybe even unacceptable, coming directly from the comedian himself?
Are the puppets a shield for testing the limits?
It seems plausible. His sales figures, those millions of tickets and DVDs worldwide, they suggest that for a huge number of people, the answer is yes. The puppet creates this distance, yeah. This filter.
Yeah, like an acceptable layer between the offensive joke and the person telling it. It lets the audience engage with the controversy, laugh at the incorrect humor, without maybe feeling like they're fully endorsing the sentiment behind it.
It's a strange kind of transaction, isn't it? An intellectual, emotional thing that's really unique to ventriloquism, especially the way Dunham does it.
And maybe that calculated distance, that separation between the master and the dummy saying the outrageous thing. Maybe that's his ultimate legacy.
It's definitely something to keep thinking about.
Yeah.
For you listening, where is that line between the comedian, the character they create, and the consequences of what's said? And why does a talking skeleton or a grumpy old man made of wood get away with so much more than the guy whose hand is literally up its back.
That's the power and the paradox of the puppet master.